Welcome to Stargate SG Fun, a podcast where we discuss episodes of the original Stargate series in order, but some of them we spend a lot more time on than others. I'm Trishy Mattson. With me today...
Hey there, I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm David Schaub.
And today, we are starting out talking about the Season 2 premiere, Serpent's Lair. David, take it away.
SG-1 is ready to see four Chlor-El's ship, but Apophis has another ship. Unfortunately, they're shock-grenaded, unconscious, blinded, and captured again. Apophis delays the attack until Chlor-El is healed. Apophis orders the Serpent Guard to kill SG-1, but luckily it's Bratak. Hammond is annoyed at Lieutenant Colonel Samuel's confidence, but Hammond offers no alternatives. With the gold shield up, the Naquada-enhanced nuke gold buster doesn't live up to its name. SGC continues sending Earth's best Americans to the Alpha Site colony. With Bratak in charge, they capture Chlor-El again and ring teleport to Apophis' ship, except Daniel, who is too hurt. Bratak's great plan. Bring the ships closer. Break the shield generator. Kaboom! O'Neill dislikes the dying part, so they fly away in damaged gliders. Jackson wakes up healed and Stargates away. Somehow. Apophis and Skara ring teleport away somewhere. The Space Shuttle Endeavor and the Canada Arm rescue the team. This cliffhanger conclusion is not bad. Not bad at all.
I would agree with that. It's a good episode overall, and there are some moments in it that are quite good.
There was a question from my side of, are they going to land it? Is it going to be what I experienced in the cliffhanger? Will I like the conclusion of it? And the answer is yes. This was great fun. It was wonderfully paced. I enjoyed it throughout. I have one big Stargate science question we'll get to. But other than that, I really quite liked this episode. It is great stuff.
We see Bratak again. And they do, you know, a decent job of keeping him a little hidden. Like, you hear his voice. If you're being really careful about watching, you would have realized it's him. But they do give it a little bit of suspense when he shows up. And this is Tony Amendola again. And it's pretty clear from this episode that he was kind of the reason they did Bloodlines, right? Like, and we kind of knew it from Bloodlines, too, that the real focus of the show is not poor Teal'c's wife or his son, but rather Bratak. And it's probably the right idea because he's great. He's great. And he does even more of his kind of the writing they gave him to be like this real jerk.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, kind of right and just totally inside this very different philosophy of who he is and what culture he's in and just interacting with the team. He's just great. So I really enjoyed having him back and having him interact with the team basically the whole episode. You know, he gets to be on screen most of the episode. So really liked it.
Right.
I did not recognize the voice.
Yeah.
Right. As far as Bratak being a jerk, we have later in the episode, Jack is trying to figure out a plan and he says, okay, here's what we do. And Bratak just jumps in. I will lead. You will follow. And he marches off, leaving Jack to follow. So, yes, he is... Well, you can't accuse him of being indecisive, can you?
Yep.
I really quite enjoy that O'Neill's always kicked a little bit off-footing by it.
Yes.
It's nice to see a show where they're willing to take the lead character, the hero guy, and just kick him off a bit and just say, eh... You're not really in charge here. It's okay.
Punch him in the nose.
And it works really well. I really quite like how Teal'c reacts with a daring plan. And Teal'c is so happy with Bratak's plan. There's joy on Teal'c's face.
I like when the good guys are allowed to be smart and still have the episode, still have suspense.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because there will be times when they don't do that on this show in order to make it work. And that is less compelling than when, you know, the odds are overwhelming. So you need them to be really smart to get out of it. And they do it. But, you know, but then like at one point, Bratak is like, and now we die. I just loved, you know, he was.
And Jack says, that's a bad plan.
Again, Tony Amendola, we just really, really sold this idea that, you know what, I'm satisfied with my life and we're going to do this. It's just so much fun. And then, you know, and yeah, so O'Neill is totally going to talk back to that. I liked throughout this episode that so much of the humor came from the characters
mm-hmm.
instead of, you know, them doing stupid things or them doing uncharacteristic things. Just all of the humor came from every single one of them being their true self in this episode. And it was great. It was a lot of fun.
And they keep consistent with those characters and they remember what those characters have done before. Just the simple callback of Bratak, again, using the phrase, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yep.
Repeated from a couple times in a previous episode. And you see it again here. And it's just nice. nice to know that, you know, the writers are paying attention. They're not just dashing this off and filling an hour.
Right. I checked the author, and I think this is Brad Cooper, right? So one of the kind of runners of the show. So yeah, it did make sense that he would have a good sense of how the show works, how the characters work.
It is kind of funny that Braytek is so resigned to dying, though. I mean, we have the, now we die. And then later on, he says, we die well, Teal'c. And then Teal'c says, more than that, old friend, we die free, which is a good line in and of itself. But then they don't die after all, which is, of course, even better.
But we don't hear anything more or anything about the other two serpent guards that were trained for so long, but Braytek, and unceremoniously shot without ever saying a line.
Just killed immediately. Yeah.
Life as an extra.
Well, they follow them around for like one or two scenes, and then, yep. Yeah, they're just gone. I like the thing at the beginning where the bad guys are trying to get into the room, and O'Neill finally just calls out, just a minute! Again, just they had a lot of suspense in the episode, but again, just a lot of humor going in it as well.
And also, and they do, you're right, keep very true to the characters. I like the scene where O'Neill basically is saying, well, I guess we're just going to have to blow ourselves up to take out this ship. Yep. And Jackson starts making some statements, and O'Neill thinks Jackson is going to go like, no, why are we blowing ourselves up? I'm not military. Why is this going on? And Jackson just wants to make sure the boom is bigger. And I think that was a nice little touch where O'Neill thinks Jackson's going somewhere, but he isn't. Because really, Jackson is entirely up for that if necessary.
Right. He's seen how this played out in the other world, and he's on board with whatever it takes to make this stop.
Right. And so there's one bit during the opening couple of scenes where they're putting Chlorel in the sarcophagus, and that is where the credits say, and Alexis Cruz as Chlorel/Skara. So I like when you can do that with credits, when they can make it match something that's happening in the visuals. And also, I do think I kind of gave it away to you, David, when we were talking about it the last time, that, you know, yeah, Chlorel and Skara may not really be dead. And I think I remember at the time when I've watched it for the very first time that it was a bit of a surprise to me that they brought him back. So it was nice that it could be a surprise to you, even if I kind of spoiled it.
The reality is whenever one of these episodes has a sarcophagus in the plot, it's going to get used. Chekhov's sarcophagus.
Chekhov's sarcophagus, absolutely.
Someone is going to either die or be wounded horribly and end up in it. So as soon as that occurred to me, I think it occurred to me while we were podcasting, is like, there's no way Chlorel is going to stay dead. Though I am shocked how long it took to heal him.
Some of that might have been Braytek fiddling with things, making it so that it would take longer, so that the shuttles come to their rescue. Yep. The shuttles were also a nice touch. They're like, yes, oh yeah, shuttles, they're going to save us.
These are mighty warships, right?
Mighty warships, yes. I do think of that every so often when somebody mentions a space shuttle. Oh, and then the whole subplot at the SGC, which really didn't do anything.
But I really loved how it played out with Mayborn and Hammond between them.
Not Mayborn, Samuels.
Oh, pardon. Right.
Yeah, right. I can understand the confusion given, yes, because we have met Mayborn.
Sorry about that.
But playing the same role, right? Playing the same antagonist, cocksure of himself, and like ready for just smarmy and knocking down all of Hammond's ideas. And it did strike me that subplot, the primary story reason was to give General Hammond somebody to be grumpy at.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice to have him being able to be grumpy with someone other than SG-1, as he had been at the very beginning of season one.
Right. But he has absolutely 100% justification in being outright angry. First of all, there's the entire stupidity of Samuels. They have told nothing to the rest of Earth about, hey, we're under imminent existential threat, because, hey, they came up with a new bomb that they think will work. And so he says the world will never know how close we came. I suppose the reason they don't want to tell the rest of the Earth is the fact that SGC has been poking around in stuff that the rest of the world might object to. But it's awful. There's nobody else on Earth has any clue that this thing is happening. Although you'd think maybe a couple telescopes would be pointed that way. And of course, once the bombardment started, if they did, then everyone would know.
Yep.
It is a little shocking. They put a lantern on it, but it's a little shocking how they just say that the other nations who are watching the stars didn't see anything until the big explosions. That seems pretty ridiculous. It's hard to buy that this happened with first the two nukes going off in space and then the two spaceships going off in space and no one noticing and at least figuring out that something obviously was up. I'm afraid I'm not going to really buy any Watsonian reasons for it. This is well into Doyleist land where the premise of this show is that the Stargate is secret. And I'm operating on the assumption that next to nothing is going to change that premise. therefore, just magically, no one can ever know what's going on. It's just a premise of the show.
Yeah, Samuel says they haven't scrambled any jets because they don't want to alert the Goa'uld that we know that they are there. But obviously, if the United States had scrambled its entire air capacity, the Russians would be worried, hey, they're about to come over and bomb Russia or something.
True.
Anyway, that was a fun sub-subplot, and it continues to be interesting, the interactions between Samuels and Hammond.
The thing is, I had some sympathy for Samuels in this case. I mean, they had to present him as being an ass, and they succeed. He is a jerk, but the only flaw really is, initially, he's overconfident, and then as soon as he's proven wrong, they make him out to be a brutal coward that Hammond has to put in his place. It's like, we have to hate this person, and the show is going to make us hate this person. But the reality is, the plan was not unreasonable. 1,000 megaton nukes isn't a very impressive kaboom.
Well, and it almost worked, right? It almost got Skyrim. It almost got Kor-El. Yep.
So that the plan was reasonable. It was purely the overconfidence that was the failing. And honestly, it's super unclear to me if as many jets you have in the air, if you're under orbital bombardment, I don't know if they would have been able to do anything.
They wouldn't have been useful at all. No, I don't think so. I mean, they showed like Air Force One getting clobbered in there for the grace of God anyway. So
yes.
Yeah. It would have been something, but it wouldn't have been enough. Yeah.
My favorite line regarding how this episode is a mirror, to the grace of God is when Samuel suggests finding some places to nuke. There's the suggestion of nuking Chulak. And this Hammond basically just goes, why would we do that? And that's this nice difference from what this world does versus the other world. And that I really like. That was my favorite bit of their interaction.
Good callback. Yeah.
Hammond emphasizes, I can't think of any military reason to bomb Chulak.
Exactly.
Just the war crimey reasons.
Let's see. So for speaking of like good decisions, this is going to be a bit of a jump. I do like how Apophis was like, nope, just kill him immediately. Like not being stupid, not being, you know, unwise the way Goa'uld often are.
Right.
He's like, nope, get rid of him. And of course, the only reason that doesn't work is because they've got Braytek going. And then when Apophis is castigating his son for being not very good at this at the end. There are no story reasons to make Apophis anything other than, you know, a dangerous predator in this episode. And I did, you know, I did like that. I like that he was allowed to be sort of his full range of menacing for it.
He is a good baddie. I do give note that he did have one point of sort of showing that Goa'uld arrogance. Kor-El, when he first goes to him, notices and questions his own ability to control the host.
Right. This host is strong, father.
And that shows weakness.
But Apophis basically just tells, well, get a handle on it.
And that seemed Kor-El being very wise. That was unusually wise for Kor-El. It didn't really make a difference because Kor-El doesn't do anything for the rest of the episode. But it's that point where Apophis just basically ignored what was a fairly wise statement.
Yep, no, it's true. That's true. Yeah, it is sort of funny that it didn't go anywhere. It was just kind of flavor for the episode, but it was, you know, pretty good flavor. And it also shows that Braytek's original idea of having them be pitted against each other was not unreasonable. There were ways to put little chinks between them to divide them up and to have them come against each other because they're not really on the same page entirely for everything.
Yeah, Braytek's original plan was pretty good, and Braytek's new plan also was pretty good. I quite liked the planning, and they nicely made sense and fit with both the technology, the plotting. There was this one question of, it's very convenient that 24-hour clock goes off at the right time, but bombs always go off at the time of plot.
Right, so you were wondering, how did Apophis and Kor-El get away? So they ringed to Kor-El's ship to use the gate there. And Daniel was...
Do we see that?
Yes, we did. I think we did. They ringed over...
I saw them ring, but I don't remember where they... I don't think we ever saw where they ringed to.
Well, the rings go between the ships. I don't know if...
Well...
They might go to other places within the ship, but I think it was pretty clear to me that Braytek went back and forth between the ships with the rings.
I was holding out some hope that they could have actually ringed. That doesn't sound like the right word.
Oh, yeah.
To somewhere else on Earth or the moon or just some other local space that may have actually had a Gould ring teleporter around. But yeah, it makes sense that they could have, in theory, ringed to a Chlorel's ship and then gated away.
They needed Daniel to be, you know, in the last couple of seconds to ring to Earth. Not ring to Earth, to gate to Earth. But if they didn't, therefore, have another way for Corona Apophis to get away.
Yeah, but they didn't show it, so.
They didn't show it. That's true. Technically, you don't know that yet.
Yeah, I don't know that yet. It certainly was on my list of options.
Yeah, they also didn't show them actually dying, so.
Well, they definitely didn't die.
Yeah.
there was no question that they died.
Then the very end. Actually, my only concern about this episode, the only thing that I think they could have done better is at the very end. Now, I did love Braytek meeting Hammond of Texas and making the gesture with the hand about the hair. That was fun. But the last meetup where sort of Daniel comes out and the team kind of, you know, gets together and kind of celebrates that they won. It felt very kind of tacked on for me. You know, other people might feel differently. But the only thing O'Neill says is like space monkey, right? Like it feels like, again, like they ran out of the dialogue that they could have used to make this a really good ending. In the same way they've done in past episodes.
I will confess that I didn't get that line at all.
I don't think it was supposed to make sense.
Okay.
But, you know, it's just coming back from space and then there was hugging, but there wasn't the kind of joy when you're like, oh my God, you're alive. You know, I just feel like they could have used sort of more of that. And of course, poor Teal'c wasn't allowed to react at all because he's still being stoic.
Mm-hmm.
I do wish that, you know, again, this is the biggest adventure they've had. This is the highest stakes they've seen. And they really thought that he was gone. I did like that scene with Jack and Daniel when, you know, Daniel's telling him to go. And, you know, it's a really emotional moment for Jack to have to leave someone behind. But he doesn't want to, but he recognizes the validity of it. And then just to not pay it off as well as I would have liked. Again, just everything else was neat, but I do wish they had done better with that last scene.
There was a lot in this episode. Like when writing the recap, it's like, boy, there is a lot of things they covered in here. I thought it was paced pretty well, but they just didn't have a lot of spare time to do anything unnecessary.
Yeah.
And they did succeed in having a few things which they basically repeated and repeated in the dialogue throughout the episode so that they could then give them nice endings. The not bad lines continued throughout the episode.
Yes.
And the bad day, whether it was
bad day lines, I love that.
Flowed through the episode very nicely, I thought. I mean, the best point was when O'Neill and Teal'c were talking earlier, which is, we've been in worse situations than this.
Yep.
Not to my knowledge. Thanks, Teal'c.
Yeah, that was a wonderful moment of character explication for this thing.
We're just having a bad day. And so I think they didn't do badly, because that does all get wrapped up, those bits of dialogue that are sort of spewed out across the entire episode. And I think that finished it up reasonably well. But yeah, they simply didn't have a lot of time.
I did appreciate that with Braytek at the end. They're like, oh, we have a few questions for you. And it feels like they did that entirely for the sake of not having to do the CGI again. For the game, you know, they just, you know, we don't want to have to pay for that at the end. So we're just going to have him go off and talk for a minute.
I was a little confused by the ending where Braytek says he must return to Chulak before word of the rebellion reaches them. Who's going to bring them any word?
Oh, yeah, that might have been another reason why I was pretty sure that Apophis and Corel survived.
Okay.
Because they would be the ones to go back to one of their planets and start organizing a response to it.
Okay, I guess that about does it, unless anyone else has any other thoughts about Serpent Slayer.
I have two little bits of Stargate science I wanted to throw in there.
Yes.
The first one is, it takes a lot longer to prep a shuttle launch than this show presents.
It sure does.
But it was a hilarious use of the space shuttle. But I suppose putting them in orbit for a few days waiting for the shuttle to show up would have been boring. The other one is a truly Stargate science one, which is, I do not understand how Jackson dialed Earth's origin on the Stargate inside of the ship. Now, I assume that he just pushed whatever the origin button was for that Stargate, but it's still really unclear to me exactly what that means. And of course, they didn't show him doing the dialing, so I don't really know.
They did show him doing the dialing, but not the end
they
of started, the
dialing. They showed him starting the dialing, but we didn't see the end of the dialing. So in some regards, I don't quite understand how you dial Earth as the origin on some random stargate. We've seen one example in the Antarctica episode, but in that case, that was a DHG that had been programmed to be there. I don't know if it matters, but yeah, that threw me a little bit. It's like, I'm not quite sure what that meant.
They were able to get into the spaceship in orbit around whatever planet the ship was in. So you can gate in and out of ships around orbit to a planet, is my understanding of what they've decided is possible for this show. But yeah, beyond that, I didn't really worry about it too much. It got Daniel out. That's all we really need.
Daniel has now died how many times? Do we need to have a count for how many times Daniel's died or almost died?
Having a count is not a bad idea. I will give you that. He has died twice now, at the very least.
Or at least near two, yeah. So this is number two.
Yep.
One other little call out, the nukes we see rockets being launched, which are in theory those nukes. Those are very little rockets. They're very cute. It was a very cute use of stock footage. It didn't really sell it to me, but oh well.
Well, did you notice on the TV monitor when they were showing the progression of it? It had this neat graphic thing where they took a world map and then they wrapped it around a globe as part of the CGI and then had the things kind of, the rockets kind of go around it. And I was like, wow, that's really fancy CGI for them to just be showing the rocket progress. Like, you would not have that in an actual military installation, just showing you how the rockets are going. But of course, it's decent TV.
But yes, not bad. Not bad at all.
So yeah, I think we can move on.
All right. So next we have the Serpent Slayer was, of course, wrapping up something important that's been going on. And our next episode, we start a whole new storyline with consequences that will echo into the future. Remind us what happened in the line of duty.
An off-world village is attacked by the Gould as SG-1 tries to evacuate everyone. A dying man's Gould infects Carter. Carter's sus, and Cassandra tells O'Neill that Carter's a Gould. A heavily burned villager is also a Gould and goes missing in the hospital. O'Neill, Teal'c, and Jackson all ineffectively interrogate Carter's Gould, Jul'inar, a Tokar fighting against the System Lords. The Gould hunter trivially defeats SGC's security and deals a fatal blow to Jul'inar. The hunter tries to escape, but Teal'c defuses the hostage situation with a Zat gun. Jul'inar helps Carter survive before dying.
Tok'ra.
Tok'ra.
Not Tokar. Tok'ra. Against Ra.
Against Ra, yes.
Tok'ra.
Right, so this is a really interesting episode that brings up a lot of really interesting things. So it turns out that the Gould are not an innately evil species, it's just that almost all of them are, because they can be.
99.999%. Yeah.
Having race memory probably does not help.
Yeah. I'm actually curious what David being the one who is seeing this for the first time, you know, how did this sort of opening up of the universe, of the world a little bit to different possibilities for the Gould, how did that strike you? What did you think?
This was a bit of a hard episode to watch in some ways, because this is an interesting episode in that there's a lot happening, but the show has a necessity of not moving the plot forward too quickly or the universe forward too quickly. So it's a bit sad that not a lot comes out of it. I really quite liked at the beginning of the episode, the writers have Jackson just setting up the episode massively by discussing that we still understand very little about the society and we don't want to underestimate them. It's like the writers are just hammering us saying, pay attention.
Really,
this is the setup for the episode. So that was funny. And I think it holds fairly well. It just seems funny that Jul'inar is still a Gould and still fails to be at all helpful or communicative to their own detriment. Because that really is what ends up getting them killed, is that they couldn't figure out a way of effectively communicating because they just, it's still a Gould.
Right. It's not a particularly nice character. I mean, even at the beginning, when Carter, we don't know yet that it's Jul'inar. Well, I guess we do know that it's a Gould, but Carter Jul'inar says very coldly, after Teal'c says he's seen entire civilizations wiped out for no reason, just to give the Gould pleasure, Carter says coldly, maybe the reasons weren't made apparent to you. After all, you are just a Jaffa. And the whole table kind of freezes
and looks at her.
And she's kind of mumbles, just saying what the Gould would say.
I really liked Amanda Tapping in this role. Like, she hasn't had a lot of a chance to shine, I think, in the first season. But here she shows she can be part of that, you know, that's relatively small crew of people in the show, of the actors in the show, who can play both their character and Gould symbiote. I loved her ability to do that. And I loved the fact that they gave her all these really wonderfully creepy lines to do in this thing. I loved the fact that the rest of the cast was able to interact with her like that. That was the part that really, really, I really, really liked it. Really made me like this episode.
There's no doubt that clearly Amanda Tapping had fun acting Agould, acting Carter. And I really did quite like that as well, the earlier parts of this episode.
I agree with both of you. And I was also really impressed. She changed her resting facial expression.
Yeah.
You know, it was not just the lines. Even when she's just brooding in her cell, you can see the irritation, annoyance, superiority of the new character inhabiting her body. Just from slight change in resting facial expression, it does not look like Carter.
Right, right. It looks like a whole different person. Yeah.
Or even just that moment when she realizes the gig is up with Cassandra and it's like, oh, that looks like a
ghoul. Yeah.
That's well, not
right,
good.
But you think she's going to kill
yes.
her. You think,
oh, absolutely.
You know, and that was probably the first moment where you're like, oh, something different's going on because you didn't just kill Cassandra. Although the show has played fast and loose with stuff like that in the past. But, you know, if it was really as menacing a Gould as she was portraying it as, Cassandra should be gone. And they just didn't do it.
Well, that was the choice that Julinar made. Like, yep. Julinar makes multiple choices in this story to not kill people.
Yep.
And it probably would have been in their best interest to kill people, but they didn't.
Although they would have had to come up with a way to kill Cassandra, which would not have been Unity.
It would have been tricky.
I also like Cassandra. I like that they brought back Cassandra for this, and it was like a good use of Cassandra's character.
A little hand wavy.
Cassandra has a bit of a superpower.
Used to have the Naquita bomb in her, so now she can sense gold. But still, good to see her again. Good to have that continuity and some good scenes.
So the thing that surprised me, because it felt very hand-wavy to me, because there's no sense in it, I think, that you'd be able to test for Goa'ulds just by having Stargate material in your bloodstream. Like, that just seems silly. But what surprised me was, at some point, were the writers considering keeping Cassandra around? And I don't know, I think she may show up later, but I'm not for sure it's the same actor. But really, this episode presents a problem, and Cassandra's the solution. Because they ask this question of, if we can't physically tell that a Gould has infected someone because they don't always go in from the back of the neck, well, what do? You could simply have Cassandra in the room. And you have right. a Gould detector. And they don't even ask the question. And I find it odd because that was part of the point of some of the scenes was, we have no idea whether Gould are around us at this point. But I guess they just decided... Maybe they decided not to do that. Maybe it was just a brief consideration enough to write this story.
Right. Janet Fraser says we'll just have to start giving everybody MRIs or ultrasounds when they come back from a mission. And that's certainly doable with their base technology.
But slow.
Yes, slow, definitely.
The only other Gould that they could have caught would have been the Ashrak. And those scenes, I felt they were the least interesting part of the episode, because the show is trying to do this sort of like a suspense movie, like a thriller.
Ashrak as Terminator?
You know, they just couldn't quite pull it off. They didn't have the budget. They didn't necessarily have the style of it. Like, the music wasn't really all that suspenseful, and it just didn't make me want to watch the episode more. The scenes that made me want to watch the episode more were with Carter in it, with the only possible exception being that one scene in that nondescript corridor where there's like a metal detector, except it's not really a metal detector, and it has these giant green lights on it for no good reason, and then they're flashing red when the Ashrak kind of comes through after having brainwashed that one soldier. And that was a really good visual touch, to have those giant red lights going off when that happened. So I did like that part of it, but I thought in general, you know, we kind of knew that, David, as you were saying, the Ashrak gets in really, really easily because they had to, because that wasn't the focus of the episode. They felt like they needed to show enough of all the pieces of it instead of just kind of having it happen. And that was, you know, kind of the least interesting part of it for me.
My favorite part of the Ashrak was actually Fraser figuring out what happened by a blood test.
By a blood test, yeah.
Periodic blood testing, going, oh, I know what actually is going on here.
What was she smart. What did she do? Like, what would you look at when doing that? I guess maybe...
Well, the blood type, probably the blood type changed.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, okay.
Like, something obvious like that must have occurred, yep. Where it's like, this is not the same person who's supposed to be in that bed.
You know, I do like that. I liked her in this episode.
Nice and clever. Fraser, I liked.
Or maybe the Gould biologically is releasing something that's not in a normal human bloodstream. Some kind of trace element or something.
I didn't know, because this would have been after an initial one. Like, I think they would have gotten a blood work from the Gould host earlier, because they would have done that earlier. So yeah. It was the latest blood test that was special. Something changed when the Gould replaced himself with the doctor, who was apparently still alive, but
still
I don't know
alive.
What condition they were in. Because the sensors were still showing activity.
Right. I also like the scene with Daniel and the wife. They were a little weird. I'm not sure they were played quite the best way that they could have been. But like, you know, Daniel having to ask her, you know, was there anything different about your husband? And he's like, no. So I do think, tell me what you think. It did feel like the Gould, the Tok'ra, went into this man and just kind of hung out there and they were hiding out or something.
Yes.
But did that mean that the Gould was pretending to be that man, I guess, just for months?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So, that, I mean, that's not great, right? That's not a great scenario for either the Gould or the host. Yeah.
The implication is that maybe something was wrong with the host and they would have died otherwise. Like, there's a story there we did not see.
That's true.
Or maybe this is an exceptional case because Julinar was on the run.
Right.
There's things we don't quite have as a background, but it certainly implied that that host probably was willing to.
Could be.
Or at least ambivalent enough not to put up much of a fight.
Yeah, I mean, Goulds do give you good health, for what that's worth. Yep. But I do like that scene where Daniel, you know, Daniel is awkward in general, and having Daniel have to squirm a little more with someone, that was a decent scene. And I think that actress, like, we've seen that actress in other things as well. I don't know if I because of those scenes with the Ashrek weren't necessarily as interesting, I wouldn't put this as high as the season opener.
No, definitely not.
But in the Serpent Square. But I really liked it. I really liked, you know, especially Amanda Tapping's portrayal of the Ghoul and the writing of it. You know, again, she wouldn't have necessarily been able to portray it quite so creepily and quite so such an alien fashion if the lines hadn't also been good.
Yeah, good point.
Good writing, good acting.
I liked the arguments that Julinar was trying to use, you know, the telling Teal'c that since the Tauri have become so powerful, the system lords won't let this go unchecked. You need me to help you defend the humans because of the information that I have.
Yep. Well, and even to say, I know where Share is.
Yes.
That was a nice creepy line. I also loved, like, when Daniel was there talking with Carter, Daniel wouldn't look into her eyes.
Yeah.
Because he knew that she was not who she was pretending to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I just loved the way they act. You know, O'Neill was kind of trying to take Teal'c's opinion. Oh, and that is, did we mention this already? That the Jack and Teal'c scene, where Teal'c was trying to give him pointers as to how to talk to a Gould. And, you know, Jack takes it, but he's also like, you know, I can't just pretend. It's not her.
I really, really quite like that one scene between Teal'c and O'Neill. That gives us the line which we've been discussing for lots of episodes, which is Gould arrogance. It is the Gould's greatest weakness.
Yes.
And the show is very clear that that is the case. And it is nice, and it is a wise strategy, and I quite like Teal'c telling that, even if Julinar sees through it, because Julinar is pretty clever. But at least it was a good idea, and it might have helped a little. But they take Julinar, and they basically want to have the scene where we see this possessed Carter talking with all of the team individually and giving everyone a moment to interact, and they give us all those permutations, and it's all good. It would have been nice if someone had actually come up with a strategy which could have resulted in Julinar being saved. You could take her to another world, find a host, underarmed guard, do the transition if necessary. Like, you'd think something could have been figured out. And I find it a little sad that there was no way to save Julinar, even though it was somewhat her own undoing. I liked how she basically told nothing to O'Neill, but then brought in Teal'c to actually say who they were, because Teal'c would understand.
Right.
Yeah.
But it still didn't result in anything. It still didn't accomplish anything, which, I don't know. It just felt sad to me, I think. I was just let down for plot reasons that are perfectly valid in the show.
And I like that they acknowledged that at the end of the show. Dan Carter's not just happy back to normal again. She is sad.
Yeah,
she's huddled up in her hospital bed, turned away from people who come to visit her.
Yeah.
You know, it acknowledges Sam has been through a rough experience, but also has sympathy, apparently, for the Gould that she says saved her life eventually.
Yeah, and she's grieving.
Yeah, she's grieving, and I think it was well done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. And not something we see a lot of in the show. Another thing I was thinking of with the Teal'c and Jack scene is, you know, the last time those two were shown acting together was when Jack was being really, really silly about black holes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually really like this scene a lot more, where Jack gets to be reasonable about things, reasonable and emotionally, you know, emotionally vulnerable a bit. It's actually, again, just really liked it.
I do like the show's consistency that Carter's preferred weapon is still grenades. Always with the grenades.
Grenades. Yep. Yeah. Scene where, like, in the gate room. Oh, and this is another thing I wanted to mention. So I have actually been going on and on, perhaps to your dismay, about the opening credits of the show. And one thing that I kept in the back of my head the entirety of season one is, hey, there's one scene in the credits which actually looks like it's from this episode. And I did double check. And so for one, the season one and the season two episodes, at least ones that I have, that are the syndicated credits, so they're, you know, scenes from the show mostly, are exactly the same. So they didn't change anything between S1 and S2. But there is that scene of Carter pacing impatiently in front of the gate that, David, you probably wouldn't notice that it was, hey, this doesn't seem to be appearing in any of the S1 episodes. That's because it's from season two. It's from here. And that's an interesting choice. Like, it does seem to mean that they didn't release the season one box set until season two had started airing, maybe, or at least had done some filming for it. It's just an interesting thing.
Yeah, because there was some oddities about when they produced these various openings that didn't really align to the original production schedule.
Right, but I think that probably also means, like, if these are the ones from syndication, that would mean that season one didn't go into syndication until season two was already at least partially filmed. It was just interesting to me how that worked. It is a great scene with her pacing in front of the gate and then kind of being confronted by everyone and finally using, you know, the glowing eyes and the voice on the rest of the team. It was a nice little dramatic scene. So I could see why they'd want to put some of it in the credits, but it's an interesting choice. So yeah, I think that's it for me for this episode.
I did really like the use of the zap gun for hostage negotiation. You shoot once, you stun both of them, you shoot again on the one person you want to kill. Very nice hostage negotiation. I thought that worked really well. I wanted to note that at the beginning of the episode, I entirely assumed that the village was being attacked because of SG-1. It was something they did. It was their fault. So it actually took me a moment to double back and go, oh, it wasn't their fault that the village was all being killed off. I don't know. I just assumed it.
That's still a good tendency for you to take.
I thought it was safe to assume that.
Yeah.
There was also a one-off line saying we now have SG-10, 11, and 12.
Yep.
So the number of teams are still increasing. Mm-hmm. We'll have to get to the next episode to discuss what some of those teams do.
Yep.
So that was kind of nice. It was an okay episode. It was nice world building that I expected to happen, but I just hope to see maybe the next time we meet Tok'ra that something comes out of it other than just sadness. Because the enemy of your enemy is your friend, and they failed to make friends.
Right. Well, I'm sure you've looked at the list of episodes for this season.
Oh,
and we're
that's
doing
right. Yeah,
the Tok'ra part one and Tok'ra part two. So yes, we will be seeing them again.
Bit of a spoiler there, yeah.
Shocking. Okay. Shocking.
Yep. Well, and one of the things, and I will say that there is more follow through in this season. So that is something to look forward to. Something I really liked about this season. Mm-hmm. So
I expect so. As we've discussed before, it's something I expect from this show, and the first season is where you're going to get the least amount of it. But now there are things to call back to, and when you call back to something, that means you need to extend forward as well. So I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, well, moving on to our shallow dives. Andrew, I believe you have a recap for the next one, Prisoners.
I do. Yeah. It's another kind of one-off episode for the show. So the SG-1 goes to a swamp planet. And while they're there, they unknowingly help an escaping prisoner. And so for this, they're sentenced by the people in charge of the planet, the Tal'Dorei, to life imprisonment in an underground jail on another planet, reachable only by Stargate. So this prison has no guards and a brutal culture, but they befriend a mysterious woman called Winnea, who offers them a form of organic cold fusion if they will help her escape. So with Linnea's help, they escape actually rather easily through the Stargate. But then they are told by another escapee that she is actually the Destroyer of Worlds, the originator of a deadly widespread virus. Linnea dials out and escapes, crashing the SGC computer system so they can't follow her. And that's the end of the episode.
I just want to note, that was a BC rainforest. We know because O'Neill said, as much as I like a good rainforest.
He actually said that? Oh, I don't remember that
part. He absolutely says that.
Okay.
They found moss and trees.
This is, a lot of genre shows do prison episodes. And so this is SG-1's prison episode. And it was pretty blah. It had a lot of cliches in it and things that didn't really, weren't really all that interesting. But, you know, they put a lot of effort into it. There is one moment, and I'll give a little bit of a content warning here, where sexual assault is mentioned in a way that I was actually a little surprised watching it again. But they decided that mentioning it had to be part of their kind of prison, menacing prison ambiance, so they did, and it wasn't really worth it. I do think that Guinea could have been a lot more interesting than she was. Certainly by the end, she has become more menacing because she crashes her computer and she takes a lot of information away that they shouldn't have been giving her.
Nope.
But kind of throughout, she's just kind of this old lady that they talk to. And so I think they could have added more layers to it. They could have had it be more menacing throughout, and they just didn't. Although I do like that actress. Again, I don't know the name, Andy. I think she's been in other things that I've seen. And remember, I was just saying how it was nice in the season premiere that the team wasn't inattentive and bad at their job for the sake of the plot. Well, you know, here they're pretty much inattentive and bad at their job for the sake of the plot. O'Neill says, like, oh, that, you know, in prison, you gotta make the hard choices in prison. But still, come on. They should not have given her as much freedom as they did, and maybe use her to get out of the place, but then maybe not show her all the computers. So Carter especially was just not very smart.
Yes, that was definitely bad operation security there to just let, oh, here are the computers and here's how you get on and everything like that. I do think they did a little bit of layering because they did talk in the prison about how people didn't just seem to respect her. They seemed to fear her. But
feared her. Yep, yep.
But they need to use her, so they just kind of ignore that and go on using her. So a couple of things this episode reminded me. First off was the Star Trek Next Generation episode where Wesley walks on the grass and gets and gets sentenced to death. In that case, they have to work hard to not have him die because the prime directive. In this case, the technology of this world is actually advanced to Earth, so they can't just send in a rescue party by force. So that was interesting. It's interesting also that Hammond actually goes off-world in this episode, yeah. Because he gets impatient with the United States diplomat who is not making much progress, so he goes over there to be forceful and doesn't get a lot farther, actually.
Not a lot comes out of Hammond or the SG-9 crew, because this is SG-9. SG-9 is apparently the diplomatic corps, and I quite like that. I quite liked the SG-9 guy. I thought he did really well at trying to do the best at doing his job and not get Hammond killed.
Right.
And I enjoyed Hammond trying to be as forceful as he could, but they just would have none of it. And I kind of like that they failed. Like, this episode has a lot of failure in it. This isn't really a good showing for the most part. The only thing they succeed in doing is running a Stargate with a bunch of moss, and boy, that seemed too easy.
Well, but, you know, organic cold fusion seems like it probably isn't a good idea. Yeah,
I don't know, it just seemed so easy to use. Yep. That Stargate, I was a little disappointed there, and the security at the end was ridiculous. But yeah, other than the SG-9 diplomatic failures that I really enjoyed watching, I quite like that. The one thing I will definitely give Linnea credit for is she is the first person to get it right. There are permutation numbers in the billions.
I did think of you when
she wins. She finally actually got a reasonable estimate of the number of permutations for Stargate entry, and that just shows us that she is smart, and considering she instantly takes over their entire computer system, obviously she is smart.
Yeah.
This episode was iffy and used up its time on the wrong things.
Yes. Let's see, one other thing that this episode reminded me of was Lois McMaster Bujold's story, The Borders of Infinity, where her usual protagonist, Miles, gets himself sent to a prison planet because he's trying to help the Resistance. And in that prison also is a place where people just get dumped and they have to make their own rules and society, and food is delivered every so often and you have to fight over it and stuff. And so that's a good story if any of our listeners want to look it up if they haven't read it before. I thought the prison was somewhat interesting, how they did their society, but you probably couldn't have explored it much more in a 1-hour episode. So that's okay.
Yep.
I really want to understand why you could look at the cauterized feet of all the people that were standing in front of the gate and assume that it's any form of escape other than suicide. Maybe they were committing suicide via the gate and that was their choice, but I did not understand this entire plot that was a believed way of getting out. Yeah. When there's this collection of body parts that would slowly collect burnt up on the bottom of the floor.
Yeah. Yeah, you're free, but you don't have your feet.
Just the ending line that we have in the show is on the computer screen as the system is crashing. Linnea has typed, presumably directed at Carter, "Thank you for your kindness. all debts have now been paid because Carter helped Linnea. It's kind of ominous. It means now I don't owe you anything and I can do whatever right. I feel like doing to you. It's just that I'm going to go somewhere else for a while.
I'm operating on the assumption that we are going to see Linnea again.
Yeah, it's the Hathor pattern. Somebody dramatically gets away. And yeah. You know, half of what's interesting about it is that there's the chance of seeing that villain again.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all we need to talk about that. That really is all we need to talk about that.
All right. Yep. And Andrew, next one, Gamekeepers.
Right. And so this one, I didn't even recommend that David watch at all, which was the right choice.
Thank you.
So, yeah, so the team goes to a non-Goa'uld garden world, and they are sucked into these pods, which then turn around and show O'Neill and Jackson their most traumatic memories over and over. Eventually, the quote-unquote keeper, played by Dwight Schultz, so, you know, Reginald Barkley, playing an alien in the Stargate universe, introduces himself, inviting them to try different courses of action to change the tragic events. But once everyone kind of realizes that this is some sort of simulation and not the real thing, and all they're doing is seeing the traumatic events over and over with no real reason, they just refuse to play the game. So the keeper kicks them out of the virtual world, except, of course, it turns out that he's only simulating a return to Earth. And after more shenanigans, including some very, very dodgy behavior by the simulated General Hammond, SG-1 eventually finds a portal out of the virtual world, both for themselves and for the other residents that the Keeper has been keeping there. And now the Keeper must deal with the fact that the residents are wandering around his garden, picking flowers and mucking things up as SG-1 returns home. So, yeah, so David, you were saying in the last episode, you know, they spent time on the wrong things, and that just feels like what this whole episode was about.
This episode was the wrong things, that's what you're saying?
They wanted to have the dramatic tension of the characters being sort of tormented by these scenes, but once you knew that it was all virtual, there was no dramatic tension, because all they would have to do is just not engage and remove themselves emotionally from the proceedings to stop. The show portrayed that, but then did not have any answer to the fact that, well, now there's nothing interesting going on there. Keeper, you know, was trying to fool them about going back to Earth, but then had General Hammond say all these completely uncharacteristic lines. General Hammond basically ordered them to go back into the pods, which, of course, was not something he would ever do. So, of course, they could figure it out. Whereas if they had wanted to have that be of any tension whatsoever, they could have tried to play it more straight and have the team actually go out and do more things and imagine more worlds. Yeah, there's just so many different ways that they could have done it better. Pluses to this episode, and they're not very many, is, again, Reginald Barkley in Stargate. That was kind of fun. He was hamming it up and trying to be sort of funny. And so, you know, it was kind of fun. Because it was a scene from Jack's past, we got to see Kowalski again. So that was kind of fun. But again, they used him pretty badly, so it wasn't actually that much fun, but it was a little bit of fun. And then, you know, they kind of tried to have this fun little bit at the end where the keeper was trying to prevent everyone from picking flowers. And all that really did was contrast the fact that he was so tormenting SG-1 earlier. Like, okay, is he a monster or is he a figure of fun? And of course, they never really wanted to make the decision on that.
I was trying to figure out whether he was a real person or an AI. Was he one of the members of that society that had just been left as caretaker? Or was he an AI that had been set up to rule and take care of the people while the system recovered and then just decided that they're better off sleeping forever so as not to mess up
right.
its orderly world? I do, just because of the reactions and the weirdnesses, I kind of tend toward the second, that it's actually an AI.
It did seem like he had a real body at the end when he was interacting with everyone else. Of course, I suppose they could. The fact that the bodies were supposed to have survived for like thousands of years, maybe they were all artificial, who knows? So yeah, I could totally see that. It actually would have been kind of nice to have that be part of the story so that it becomes more of AI thinking they know better than humans, but they didn't do that. And they were humans. They did say they were humans in the pods.
I believe so.
Which also makes it weird because then they would have had to have come from basically a Goa'uld or like somebody, some other alien race to get there. And that wasn't really, but that wasn't part of the story. And I'm thinking about it way more than they probably did. So I'm going to stop that. But again, this is another one of these. They needed to make up a new world and a new plot and a new challenge from whole cloth, and it's just not one of their better outings for it. So yep. It's unfortunate, especially with, you know, again, Dwight Schultz being right there for you to use, and they just didn't use Mother One. We do get a little bit of background on the characters. We get to see how Daniel's parents died, because I think he said he was adopted in the movie. So we do see a little bit of that. And again, we see a mission that O'Neill goes on in 83, I think they said it was. And again, these should have been way more interesting than they were, but they weren't.
Yep. So.
I don't think I feel that bad for missing it.
No.
Well, I guess that's it for the episodes for this week. I will point out that the latest episode of Inconceivable, the game show on The Incomparable, does have a this, that, or the other category that includes names of Gould from Stargate. So I had great fun listening to that.
Yep. I got all of them, which is great. I knew nothing of the other ones, but I knew all the Gould. I also appreciated their struggles to pronounce yes. the word Gould. That was adorable and totally in keeping with what we've mm-hmm. been talking about. Yeah, that was fun. Yeah, it was a little unfortunate that the quality of the episodes went steadily downhill throughout this podcast. Yeah, not a great way to end. Yeah, hopefully we'll get into some better ones.
Yes, we will.
As we go for this season.
Okay, well, I, of course, would like to thank you too for another fun and interesting conversation about Stargate.
Yeah.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great.
And thanks to our listeners for listening to us. If anyone would like to continue the conversation with us, you can check us out on Twitter.
At Stargate_SG_fun.
That will be it for this time. And we'll be talking with you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.